So you buy a home for $80,000, you take, you know, meticulous care of it for 30 years, and then you accidentally hand your child a staggering six-figure tax bill the very moment you try to pass it on to them.
It's a total nightmare scenario, but it happens all the time.
Right. Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we're looking at estate planning, which is a world that often feels like, well, assembling complex furniture without the instruction manual.
That is a very accurate way to put it.
Right. You try to wing it, you bypass the proper structure, and the whole thing just collapses when the real weight of the legal system bears down on it.
Exactly.
We've pulled together a really fascinating stack of sources for you today. We're talking Florida bar pamphlets, legal guides, and even, surprisingly, historical profiles of a beloved first lady.
Yeah, it's a really unique blend of tax law, elder care strategy, and a bit of American history all rolled into one.
It really is. And our mission today is to dissect a highly specific, very powerful legal shortcut for passing on real estate.
And we're going to uncover how a basically a fictional textbook scenario somehow morphed into real world law.
Which is wild. And it's saving families from devastating financial headaches. Now, we know most of you listening already understand the basics here.
Right. You know, a standard will isn't some magic shield against the court system.
Exactly. A will just tells the probate judge how you want things divided up. But the actual goal for most people is bypassing that courtroom entirely.
Oh, absolutely. Avoid it at all costs.
But okay, let's unpack this for a second. Why is the system so eager to pull property into probate in the first place?
Well, it really comes down to how the law views the cessation of ownership. I mean, when a person dies, their legal ability to hold title to anything just vanishes.
Right, because they aren't a legal entity anymore.
Exactly. So the state needs a formal, supervised mechanism to transition that title to a living person or a new entity.
Makes sense.
And according to the Florida bar pamphlet we reviewed, probate is that default court-supervised process.
So its job is basically to identify assets, pay off lingering debts, and then distribute the remainder.
Right. But the problem isn't just the concept of distribution, it's the execution.
Yeah, because it's a court process, right? So it becomes part of the public docket.
Completely public. Anyone who wants to can just go down to the courthouse or honestly just log online and look up the exact value of your family's finances.
Which nobody wants.
No, not at all. And along with that public exposure, the Florida bar notes that settling even a, you know, a routine estate typically takes 5 to 12 months.
Wow. Up to a year. Just for a routine one.
Yep. And during all that time, you're incurring professional fees for attorneys, filing fees, court costs.
So it actually drains the very estate you're trying to pass down to your kids.
Precisely. Which explains why people desperately look for workarounds.
They try to wing the assembly, like the furniture analogy.
Exactly. And the Smart Asset Source outlines the most common trap here, which is the quitclaim deed.
Oh, right. Where homeowners just figure they'll slap their kid's name on the deed while they're still alive.
Yeah, they think, you know, the kid is on the title, so no probate needed.
Boom, solved. But that's a trap, right?
It is a massive, well, a huge trap. It trades a temporary legal headache for a permanent financial disaster.
Okay, wait, explain that.
So when you add your child to the deed of your house while you are alive, the IRS classifies that transfer as a gift.
Okay.
And because it's a living gift, it triggers a tax mechanism known as carryover basis for capital gains.
All right, let's break down the math on that because this is where families get completely blindsided.
Yeah, so let's go back to that $80,000 house from earlier. Say you bought it decades ago.
Right.
Today, the market value is up to $450,000.
Sure. Pretty standard appreciation.
Right. If you just add your child to the deed today, the IRS says their tax basis, which is the starting line used to calculate their future profit, carries over directly from you.
Meaning it stays locked at that original $80,000.
Exactly. So if you pass away and your child decides to sell that house the very next month for $450,000.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. The IRS looks at that sale and says, congratulations, you just made $370,000 in profit.
Oh, wow. So they get hit with capital gains taxes on that entire difference.
All because the parent wanted to save, you know, a few thousand dollars in probate fees. It is a terrible trade-off.
That is brutal. And before we move past these flawed fixes, I do want to touch on tools designed for the living. Because the National Council on Aging source details the power of attorney.
Right, the POA.
Yeah, people often think, oh, my child can just sell the house or manage the estate using a POA. And there are medical POAs for healthcare, financial POAs, springing POAs.
Which only activate if you become incapacitated.
Right. And durable POAs that stay active even through dementia or a coma. But there's a fatal flaw here for estate planning, isn't there?
There is. The fatal flaw of the power of attorney is rooted in agency law. A POA makes someone your agent, meaning their legal authority is entirely derived from your legal authority.
Okay.
So the second your heart stops, you cease to exist as a legal entity.
So if a will still drags you through public probate and adding a kid to a deed ruins their tax situation and a POA evaporates at death, What is the actual fix? We need an actual structural mechanism to seamlessly pass down real estate.
Well, historically, property law offered a solution by slicing ownership, not by percentages, but by time.
By time.
Yes, this is the concept of the life estate.
Okay, splitting ownership over time, how does that practically work for like a family home?
You divide the title into two distinct simultaneous phases. The original owner usually becomes the life tenant.
Okay.
They hold the absolute right to occupy, use, and generate income from the property for the remainder of their natural life.
Got it. And the second phase?
That belongs to the remainder man. This person holds a vested future interest.
Meaning they don't get to use the house today? But their future ownership is totally locked in.
Precisely. And the key mechanism here is that the moment the life tenant dies, the remainder man automatically absorbs full immediate ownership.
And that happens outside of probate.
Exactly. By operation of law, completely bypassing the probate court. Because the deed already dictated the transfer before the death even occurred.
That's fascinating.
Oh, and as a quick side note, if you base this duration on the lifespan of a third party rather than the person living there, the law uses the French term pour autre vie, meaning for the life of another.
Pour autre vie. I like that. So that bypasses probate, which is great. But looking at the sources, the rigidity of a standard life estate seems kind of suffocating.
It can be, yeah.
I mean, if I'm the life tenant and I suddenly need to sell the house to afford assisted living, or I just want to take out a home equity line of credit to fix collapsing roof, I can't do it on my own, can I?
You cannot. Under a traditional life estate, the remainder man's future interest is legally protected. So you need their explicit written consent to sell or mortgage the property.
That's wild. It's like owning a car, but you're stuck in the passenger seat, and you have to ask permission from the person sitting in the back seat just to change the radio station.
That's a great way to put it. And it actually goes deeper than just asking permission. The life tenant carries affirmative legal obligations to protect the remainder man's future asset.
Right.
You have to prevent what property law calls waste.
Yeah, when I read waste in the legal guise, my first thought was, you know, throwing garbage in the front yard. But it's much broader than that.
Much broader. There is voluntary waste, which is active destruction.
Like taking a sledgehammer to the drywall.
Right. Then there is permissive waste, which is passive neglect.
So ignoring that collapsing roof until the foundation rots out.
Exactly. But the most counterintuitive concept here is ameliorative waste. This occurs when the life tenant makes unauthorized modifications that actually increase the property's financial value.
Wait, I really struggle with this concept in the reading. How can I get sued by my own kids for making the house worth more money?
I know, it sounds totally backwards, but it comes down to the fundamental nature of property rights. The remainder man has a vested legal right to inherit the exact character of the property they were promised.
Okay.
So if you tear down a modest single-family home and build a highly profitable duplex without their permission, you might have increased the monetary value, but you destroyed the single-family home they were legally entitled to receive.
Wow.
Yeah, they can actually sue you for altering the fundamental nature of their inheritance.
That is unbelievable. So traditional life estates solve the probate problem, but they introduce this absolute nightmare of rigidity and potential lawsuits from your own heirs. Which brings us to the core of our deep dive today, the upgraded version of this tool, the Enhanced Life Estate Deed.
Yes.
Or as it's famously nicknamed, the Ladybird Deed.
Right. It is a brilliant adaptation of property law, currently only recognized in a handful of states.
Like Florida, Michigan, Texas, West Virginia, and Vermont, right?
Yep, those are the main ones.
The history behind the name is honestly my favorite part of the sources. I mean, if you hear Lady Bird deed. The immediate assumption is that President Lyndon B. Johnson created it to transfer property to his wife, Claudia Lady Bird Johnson.
That is the popular myth.
Yeah. And she was a monumental figure. She championed the 1965 Highway Beautification Act, practically forcing the removal of junkyards along interstates. She helped establish Head Start, fought to save the California Redwoods, founded the National Wildflower Research Center.
She was incredibly influential.
So it makes perfect sense that a specialized property law would bear her name.
It sounds like wonderful historical poetry, right?
Yeah.
But the Michigan Bar Journal research completely bursts that bubble.
It totally does.
Yeah, LBJ never used the steed.
Not once. The true origin is wonderfully mundane. In the 1980s, a Florida attorney named Jerome Ira Solkoff was drafting elder law teaching materials for a textbook.
Right.
He needed a hypothetical family for his legal examples, so he just borrowed the Johnsons. He wrote fictional scenarios where Lyndon was passing a house to Lady Bird using this new, highly flexible deed structure.
And law students learned the concept as the Lady Bird example, and the nickname simply stuck to the actual law.
Which is amazing. Solkoff effectively named a major legal instrument through a hypothetical exercise.
He really did. But, you know, the mechanics of what he was teaching are profoundly effective. The enhanced version completely flips the vulnerabilities of the traditional life estate.
Okay, so how does it untie the hands of the homeowner?
Well, in a Lady Bird deed, the life tenant retains 100% unrestricted control of the property.
So they aren't stuck in the passenger seat anymore?
Not at all. They can sell the house, keep every penny of the proceeds, take out a mortgage, or completely revoke the deed whenever they want. And they can do all of this without the remainder man ever knowing, let alone consenting.
Wait, if the owner can just tear up the deed or sell the house tomorrow, does the remainder man actually own anything at all while the owner's alive?
That is the defining legal distinction here. In a traditional life estate, the remainder man has a vested interest. It's locked in.
Right.
But in a Lady Bird deed, the remainder man only holds a contingent future interest.
So it's basically a pencil mark instead of being written in ink. It could be erased at any time.
Exactly. They get absolutely nothing until the exact moment of the owner's death, provided the owner hasn't sold the house or changed their mind in the interim.
That flexibility is incredible for family dynamics, but keeping that total control triggers some really powerful loopholes in the tax code, doesn't it?
It really does. Let's look at the immediate tax implications. When you file a standard deed transfer in Florida, you usually have to pay a documentary stamp tax, which is essentially the state's fee for transferring real estate.
Yep.
But because creating a Lady Bird deed doesn't actually move the ownership of the property yet, since you retain the power to revoke it, it doesn't trigger that tax.
Oh, nice. And it also avoids the IRS gift tax trap we talked about earlier with the quitclaim deed.
Exactly. Because it is not a completed gift. You haven't permanently given anything away, so you don't have to report it against the IRS's annual gift tax exclusion limits.
That makes perfect sense.
But the most significant financial superpower happens at the moment of death. Because the life tenant technically maintained control of the property until their last breath, the IRS considers the house part of their estate.
Which opens the door for the stepped-up basis.
Yes. When the remainder man inherits the house, their tax basis does not carry over from the original purchase price. It steps up to the fair market value on the date of the owner's death.
It's like the IRS shakes an Etch-a-Sketch.
Exactly.
If the parent bought the house for $80,000 and it's worth $450,000 the day they die, the Etch-a-Sketch is wiped clean. The child's new starting line is $450,000.
Yep. They could sell it a week later and owe zero capital gains tax on those decades of appreciation.
It completely neutralizes the staggering tax penalty of that simple quitclaim deed. So retaining control shields you from the IRS.
Mm.
But the IRS isn't the only entity looking for a piece of an estate. The single biggest creditor most elderly people face is the healthcare system, specifically Medicaid.
Right.
The sources dive heavily into how this deed interacts with long-term care.
And Medicaid rules are notoriously strict. If you require government-funded nursing home care, Medicaid enforces a 5-year look-back period.
So they comb through your finances.
Exactly. If they see that you gave away a house or substantial assets within the last 5 years to intentionally impoverish yourself and qualify for aid, they will hit you with severe penalty periods where they basically refuse to pay for your care.
But the Lady Bird deed slips right past that look-back period, right?
It does, because of that contingent factor. The government agrees that a Lady Bird deed is not a completed transfer of assets.
Because you could still revoke it.
Exactly. You haven't given the house away. You just stated an intention for what happens after you die. Therefore, signing the deed does not trigger a Medicaid penalty.
And it continues to work as a shield even after you pass away.
Yes, through the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program.
MERP.
Right. When a Medicaid recipient dies, the government attempts to recoup the hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on their care by going after whatever is left in their estate. But crucially, federal law typically restricts them to recovering from the probate estate.
And because the Lady Bird deed automatically shifts ownership the millisecond you die, the house never enters probate. The
Exactly.
government opens the probate door, and the house is already gone. I have to admit, looking at all this, it feels like an absolute legal cheat code.
It really does seem that way.
You get to keep your house, qualify for Medicaid, dodge the recovery program, and pass the property to your kids tax-free. If this is so airtight, why isn't every single person using it instead of paying thousands for a comprehensive trust? There has to be a catch.
Well, there is. Because a deed is a blunt instrument, whereas a trust is a scalpel. The Lady Bird deed is powerful, but if you use it in complex situations, you can create spectacular disasters.
I want to dig into those disasters, starting with the University of Florida Advisor Network source. It completely shifted my perspective on charitable giving
Oh,
because
absolutely.
it seems so noble, right? A donor names their favorite university or charity as the remainder man on a Lady Bird deed. The donor dies, and the charity gets a valuable piece of real estate to fund their mission.
And it works beautifully if the property is a pristine condo. It becomes a catastrophe if the property carries environmental baggage.
Right.
Let's say the donor leaves a beautiful old farm, but decades ago, someone buried leaking agricultural chemicals on the back acre. Or maybe it's a commercial plot that used to be a dry
And
clean.
that triggers Superfund or CERCLA liabilities. Those are the federal laws concerning the cleanup of hazardous waste.
Yep. And under CERCLA, the current owner of the property is strictly liable for the cleanup costs, which can run into the millions. And because a Lady Bird deed transfers ownership automatically and instantly at the moment of death, the charity becomes the legal owner of a toxic brownfield before they are even notified the donor has died.
They don't even get the chance to inspect the property or reject the gift. They just wake up one morning with a huge EPA liability.
It is a chilling scenario for any nonprofit. And the complexities multiply if a donor decides to be generous to several organizations at once. Say they split the deed equally among three different charities.
The legal term the sources use here is tenants in common.
Yes. The moment the donor dies, those three distinct charities are instantly thrust into a mandatory business partnership.
Oh, that sounds messy.
Very. They share the liability for property taxes, insurance, and maintenance. If the roof leaks, all three boards of directors have to agree on how to fund the repair.
And if they want to sell the house.
They have to unanimously agree on the listing price and the real estate agent. It creates total administrative gridlock.
So using a blunt instrument for charities is super dangerous. But what about using it within the family? The Florida bar sources highlight that Florida's homestead laws present a unique minefield for this deed.
Oh, definitely. Florida's Constitution fiercely protects the primary residence, primarily to ensure that surviving spouses and minor children are not suddenly left homeless.
Which is a good thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the law is absolute. You cannot use any tool, including a ladybird deed, to disinherit a spouse or a minor child from the homestead.
What happens if someone tries? Say someone wants to leave the house entirely to a sibling and cuts out their spouse.
The state simply invalidates that portion of the deed. The law automatically steps in and forces a specific distribution, usually giving the surviving spouse a life estate or forcing a half-interest split between the spouse and the children. You literally cannot draft your way around the state's homestead protections.
Wow. That brings us to a really fascinating point raised by the TIAA financial advisory source regarding blended families. Because a Lady Bird deed only requires a signature and a notary, it's incredibly easy to execute. TIAA warns that a spouse in a second marriage might quietly use one of these deeds to direct the family home exclusively to their children from a previous marriage.
And they might do it without the current spouse ever knowing because the deed doesn't require the remainder man's signature.
Exactly. TIAA explicitly warns that this lack of transparency leads to brutal, highly emotional probate battles. The surviving spouse and their children are completely blindsided by a lopsided wealth transfer the day after the funeral.
The emotional fallout is immense. And this really highlights the ultimate limitation of the Lady Bird deed compared to a trust, which is the complete lack of guardrails.
Right. With a trust, you can build in conditions. You can say, my child inherits the house, but the trust manages it until they turn 35. Or the trust holds the house so my child's creditors cannot seize it.
Exactly. A ladybird deed offers none of that protection from the grave. It drops the asset squarely into the lap of the remainder man immediately.
So if your beneficiary is, say, drowning in credit card debt.
Or if they're in the middle of a bitter divorce, or if they just have a history of terrible financial decisions, that house is immediately exposed to their creditors and their poor judgment.
You trade the upfront expense and complexity of drafting a trust for the cheap simplicity of a deed, but you sacrifice all control over what happens next.
It requires looking at the entire landscape of your family's dynamic, not just finding the cheapest way to bypass the courthouse.
Synthesizing everything we've pulled from these sources, estate planning clearly isn't just about stubbornly filling out paperwork to dodge a fee.
No, not at all.
It's about strategically selecting the right vehicle. You have to decide if your family needs the precision of a comprehensive trust, the simple instructions of a will, or the oddly named flexibility of a ladybird deed. The ultimate goal is ensuring your family is protected, your tax burden is minimized, and your private life stays off the public docket.
And understanding the mechanics of these tools is the only way to make an informed choice.
Absolutely. And for you listening, whether you are trying to figure out your own long-term plans or you're stepping in to help aging parents navigate the terrifying maze of Medicaid rules and capital gains taxes, knowing these specific mechanisms changes the dynamic entirely.
It really does.
It empowers you to sit down with your legal advisors and ask highly targeted questions. That knowledge alone can save your family immense amounts of time, emotional stress, and money.
Knowing what questions to ask is often the most valuable asset you can possess.
Which brings us to a final fascinating thought to mull over. We spent today looking at a powerful, real-world legal shortcut. A tool used by thousands of families to shield their life savings from taxes and medical recovery. And it was essentially named after a random attorney's fictional textbook example from the 1980s. It makes you wonder what other purely fictional scenarios or hypothetical academic arguments have quietly slipped into the lexicon to shape the very real laws that govern our lives and our legacies today.
It certainly proves that the law is a living, breathing thing shaped by the people who teach it just as much as the people who write it.
It really does. I want to say a genuine thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us on this deep dive today. We really appreciate you taking the time to unpack all these mechanics with us, and we'll catch you on the next one.